Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Engaging the Phenomenon. And we are honored to have a returning guest. He was actually on for the first interview I did here on Engaging the Phenomenon. And that is our good friend, Daniel Ingram, MD. So welcome, Daniel.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and it's great to have you back. And for people listening, you're an MD. So you dealt with, I believe, trauma medicine. Emergency medicine. See, there you go.
That's right.
And you also happen to write a book called Mastering the Hardcore Teachings of the Buddha.
Something like that. Yeah, Mastering the Core Teachings of the Buddha. Yeah, an unusually hardcore Dharma book. That's right.
And So that got you into an interesting position where you and Vince Horn started the Dharma Overground.
That's right. Yeah.
And so similar to me, where I was, you know, I created the CE5 initiative platforms and was getting to interact and share stories and, you know, learn from and share with all these different people going out and doing CE5 work, you and having contact experiences, but you basically did the same thing in kind of like the Dharma world with the Dharma Overground.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. I mean, there are some other projects like that, but yeah, it was one of the first ones that really talked about deep end phenomena and encouraged that kind of thing, where people were having deeper meditative and psychedelic and other spontaneous and experiences and in other settings as well.
Yeah. And because of that, you ended up forming something called the EPRC. So can you tell us what the EPRC is?
Absolutely. So the Emergent Phenomenology Research Consortium was co-founded by me and about 20 of us. So about a little over 3.5 years ago, an MD PhD at Cambridge invited me to spend the summer there. And she said, hey, it's ridiculous that I can't talk about my most powerful spiritual experiences. Help me be the change we want to see in the world. And so I spent a summer at Cambridge University trying to think about how in the world we could reasonably do that, looking at all the previous attempts, going back to the cosmic consciousness kids in the 1880s, and then William James and Abraham Maslow and Esalen and the transpersonal people and metapsychiatry and Stanley Dean and all of these iterations of these attempts. And then before we knew it, people were like, hey, what are you doing with your summer? And I'm like, oh, trying to make this project work. And they were like, hey, great, can we help? And by the way, they also happen to have had very interesting spiritual, mystical, magical, meditative experiences. And they also happen to be at universities like Harvard and Oxford and MIT and Brown and Stanford and Yale and Berkeley and, you know, all these cool places. And sorry if I left some out. There are a lot of great universities represented in the EPRC. And before we knew it, we had founded this group, and it's grown now to almost 200 people. And we have people at every stage of their careers, from people who are in college to emeritus, you know, professors and retired people, and people across a wide range of disciplines, neuroscientists, clinicians, meditation teachers, computational linguists, and AI and machine learning people. A lot of tech people seem to find this project interesting. And basically, what we're trying to do is figuring out how we can remove a lot of the problems that come from the clinical mainstream and the scientific world, basically looking at everything that we would call emergent phenomena, which you would call probably spiritual, mystical, magical, energetic, psychedelic phenomena, psi phenomena, et cetera, which would definitely include a lot of the stuff around the phenomenon, as you call it, right? And so a lot, you know, it's obviously well in that territory. And figuring out how the clinical mainstream at the deep structural levels, so like the DSM, ICD-10, 11 billing codes, WHO, you know, board certification criteria, medical textbooks, all that level, can have a much better relationship to an answer and response to reports of all of that stuff other than is crazy, needs meds, right? So that's basically the current response, if you look in the books, about all of this stuff, is crazy needs meds. And we think that, you know, they can do better than that, and that we can help them get the evidence quality and the protocols and the things in place and the standards of care developed and the prospective clinical trials of comparing methods of diagnosis and management and cultivation, all that stuff that will help our fellow colleagues and scientists to relate much more skillfully and with a much broader and more expansive, and we think more ethical palette to the deep end of spiritual, mystical, magical, et cetera, experiences, including things like senses of having been abducted or had encounters with alien intelligences or seeing things in the sky or whatever it is that may, or and all these additional curious things that can follow from that, right? Because as we were talking about before we started recording, obviously people often not just, they don't have an encounter, but they have an encounter and then it not only changes the way they look at the world, but it may even give them enhanced abilities, other experiences, open them up to other perceptual dimensions of, you know, that are reported across a whole lot of different cultures. And so that's what the EPRC is about. And so I help organize and volunteer to help run the EPRC.
Yeah. And, you know, as we were talking about before we started recording, you know, it's often that somebody has an encounter and then, you know, or either which way, it's either, you know, somebody has an encounter and after that they end up having what are called post-contact effects and they have other experiences within those realms, sometimes considered contact modalities, but they, some of them go on to have out-of-body experiences or even near-death experiences are, in, you know, percentage or statistically wise high in experiencers for some reason. So, you know, somebody will have a near-death experience and then afterwards they'll have a kind of UFO encounter. It's not uncommon that those things come about. So that's why I think it's, what you're doing with the EPRC is highly relevant because, again, these kind of phenomena, they affect your life. And where do you turn to, right? It's, right. You know, I mean, if you turn to your friends, they could, you know, think you need help, right? Because it's not, there's still sure. somewhat of a stigma, right?
Depending on who your friends are and what kind of place they're coming from. Sure.
Yeah.
My friend circles would all be like, oh, interesting. Tell me about that. And they would add it to their catalog. But, you know, it depends on the circles you run in.
Well, right. I do have friends that they're kind of in the closet and they're because of their job and even their family doesn't even know how involved they are in this kind of work. You know,
more than half of the EPRC members are not listed on the website. You won't find them anywhere. They're not in the white paper. Yeah. And because of that exact reason. Sure.
Yeah. So, you know, again, I think what EPRC is doing is kind of like ahead of its time in a way. It's very important and it's relative to, I think, when, you know, the UFO phenomenon is being more public and mainstream. And hopefully with that, there will be more of an opening and perspective about the kind of things that we talk about with emergent phenomena. And, you know, speaking of, you know, people that have contact encounters, maybe some people want to go out and they want to do something like CE5 or heist or contact work. But I did do recently a disclaimer video talking about that, right? Because you, just like in the meditation world, you've talked about like disclaimers, right? Like for people that are like just seeking emergent phenomena, what would be your disclaimer to them?
So the problem is, how do you give informed consent for something like this is the real question that I seriously still struggle with. It would be kind of like trying to give informed consent for puberty. Let's say puberty was something optional and something you could choose. And you could say, okay, to kids, do you want to go through puberty, right? You know, it's very hard to figure out how you would actually describe everything that might involve in a way that they could relate to and would be okay and would be appropriate to their level of understanding and yet still give them informed consent. And so that's the problem we struggle with, is if you're going to do practices that can lead to experiences that are beyond your current level of understanding, you know, how does that work? Can you really give someone an in-depth discussion with high quality data on the risks, benefits, and alternatives of doing some sort of a, you know, an encounter protocol or doing a psychedelic, for example? If you've never done a psychedelic and you've just had ordinary consciousness experiences, whatever those are, right? Can you really give people consent for that? You know, you could say, hey, it's kind of like this, but until they've actually had it, you know, that it's a funny thing, right? And so medical ethics yet demands that we attempt this at least. And in attempting this, at least you could have some data. So what I would like is some outcomes data like the scientist in me and the doctor in me would like people to have a sense, hey, if I do this protocol, here's the chances I might see nothing. Here's the chances I might see or experience something. If I do see or experience something, what might be the effects of that? And then how do I deal with those, right? It could be paradigm changing. It could be scary. It could be amazing. It could be life transforming. It could be healing. It could be disconcerting or confusing, not only for you, but the people around you, right? So there's a really cool book called The Flip by Jeffrey Kripal, who I know you know, and had speak at the previous conference that you ran. And his book, The Flip, is really important. And the sort of the step, and basically what it says is you have people who are kind of one way, let's just say kind of muggly. I don't mean that in a pejorative sense, but they're not really magical. They haven't had interesting experiences, you know, sure they're fine people, but they, you know, relatively constrained worldview. And then they have an experience that flips them into an alternate way of looking at the world that might change the way they look at consciousness or space and time, or death, or life, or who they are, or their identity, or the realms of magic, or the realms of what's possible in this life, or what else is out there, right? And so that can be, and every time somebody has a flip like that, and they go from one way of being to another way of being, right, within themselves and externally, there are going to be parts of themselves that might have really preferred the old way, and still kind of think of the world that way. And there will be parts of themselves that are adapting to the new way and may really like the new way or might not, who knows, depending on the experience, right? Not all of these are pleasant and totally benign, as you know from the endless reports. And so not only with it, and then across that divide and on that similar divide in everybody who knows them, who's now reacting to a new them, who has a new way of looking at the world, a new story, a new maybe identity or perception or paradigm, every one of those that now is relating to that flip or that split, as I call it, between one way of being and another way of being, will then also be tempted to apply what are called the psychological defense mechanisms, which can be things like projection or denial or compartmentalization or dismissal, or, you know, there's a range of these things, and might attribute all kinds of things to the person, like crazy, broken, insane, you know, confused, you know, something. And or may have other strange reactions to them, or might put them on a pedestal and think they're amazing. Like there's a lot of positive projection that can come from that as well. Oh, so lucky, special person, right? So there's, if you look at the way transference and countertransference work, and then this new person can also react to all the transference with their own countertransference, and they can get caught up in these complicated dynamics. Well, the problem is that's all so complicated. There's no way to really explain to someone all the good and bad things that might happen as a result of doing these protocols. But the scientist in me, what I really would like is high quality outcomes data. Like let's say you took 100 people and you had them do some protocol, like a CE5 protocol or something, and 100 people who didn't, and you just track them going, you know, matched controls or something, and you just track them going forward into the future, well, then at least you might have some data or something on what happens when you do these things. And the problem is, in this world of adventure and consciousness exploration, nobody actually ever does that. And even if you had data, I don't know that it would necessarily impact most people's decision-making process. I mean, if you're going to do something like that, you're probably going to do it. But maybe not. I mean, there are people who might go, wow, maybe I wouldn't do that. Or they might go, actually, I totally should do that. And the data has convinced me I never would have done that before. But now you have scientific data, and that seems to be what I want and has a risk profile that I like. I would like to do that. Thank you. So that's how I think the EPRC point of view kind of relates to these things. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, what we talked about, the, you know, somebody having maybe an experience and opening them up to all these other emergent phenomena sometimes is kind of reminiscent of Dr. John Mack's Passport to the Cosmos. You know, once you have that kind of experience, it opens you up to these different possibilities and even like a different way of being. In some cases, it transforms people, like you said. You also had some, just say like your early arising and passing experience. Can you describe that for people?
Yeah. So So first, the term Arising and Passing is a technical term from a set of Buddhist maps that come out of books like that one, but originated in the Abhidhamma and in something called the Patisambhidhamaga, which are relatively late canonical texts in the Theravada Buddhist canon. And that map is a map that I just happen to like a lot of. And basically, it has this set of steps that you would expect meditators on the spiritual path to go through. Typically, people think of this as on retreat, and then there's debate about how much it applies to people in daily life. But the descriptions of what happens really seem to match a lot of descriptions of things like peak experiences, conversion experiences. William James himself seemed pretty convinced. These all kinds of all these experiences sort of fell into a general bucket. He called becoming like twice born, or born again is another way we might say that. And so this sense of you are one way, you have an experience, and now you are transformed. And that can look like a lot of different things, but it tends to involve common elements. And common elements that it might involve are things like bright lights, visions, the sense of the body trembling or shaking, the sense of energy, the sense of body dissolving into particles or light, explosions of consciousness, and then other phenomena like seeing through closed eyelids, first travels out of body, profound sense of pleasure, bliss, rapture that can get basically off the scale. Now, not everybody has these. Some people cross the stage with much less fireworky kind of stuff, right? And it can last for seconds. It can last for weeks or months. It can be a real spiritual high, but for some people it's kind of scary and terrifying, and the energies moving through can be utterly disconcerting. Now, the first time I ever crossed into what I think of as this territory, I was just trying to have better flying dreams at about age 14 or 15. And I was having a dream where everything was super bright white. And I was standing on a dusty road with two friends. And we were all about like maybe 3 feet high. And we had silver spacesuits with, you know, helmets. And we were holding ray guns, like silver ray guns, like straight out of the 1950s. And staring, or 60s, and staring down the road. And there was all of a sudden, this cloud of dust, and out of it emerged this great black war charger horse, huge stallion, charging at us with a witch sitting on top of it. And the witch took her wand and went, ah, and this bolt of bright white light streamed out, hit us. And at this point, my consciousness just totally exploded. Like, at this point, I'm awake, sort of, except my body is like flying, exploding, sparkling fragments of sparks all over my bedroom. And or such is my experience. And then it sort of slams back together. And then I'm like buzzing for a while and like full of this sense of buzzing, tingling energy. And very shortly thereafter, I can't remember if it was that night or the next night or something, I traveled out of my body for the first time. I floated out of my body. The classic lift out of your body, look down, see yourself there, float through the wall, freak out, snap back, buzz and paralysis, and what the hell. So that was, and then I started having weird energetic phenomena. I was never really the same. And I didn't really know what to do with all that until about 10 years later when I started going on intensive meditation retreats. But on the first meditation retreat I ever went on, which is where it gets more interesting. So I was not the kind of person to say things like, I've had an alien encounter, right? I was, even though I was exploring these kinds of things, I was still very scientific, materialistic, in my kind of way of looking at the universe. And yet somehow I was drawn to meditation. And it was about day six or so of this meditation retreat. And all of a sudden, again, my body sort of became like particles and energy and waves. And just, it felt like just like wave particles of energy somehow moving around incredibly fast. And then all of a sudden it felt like I was catapulted up through the ceiling. And then there's a weird gap. And I don't know what to make of that. And then it feels like I'm suddenly dropped back down through the ceiling, back down to the meditation hall. And the words and the thoughts that came out of my mouth were, it just felt like I was dropped out of an alien spaceship. Now, there was no experience of spaceship. There was no aliens. I got nothing, right? I've had other entity encounters later. Those didn't come then. They came at another point. But that's a sort of a strange thing for the way I was describing it at the time. So that was, anyway, so that if, that's, these are some of these experiences. And the thing is, it is really hard from a sort of a Buddhist mappy point of view to not look at a lot of alien encounters through the lens of this kind of peak experience where there can be this energetic opening and people can go to other realms, people can see things, entities, they can have visions, they can have, you know, this is when people will feel like they were touched by the spirit or some divine presence. Sometimes, again, the range of ways this can happen is extremely wide, but it's really hard when I read some descriptions of alien encounters or abduction events, there are often a lot of elements that may make me think, wow, doesn't that look a whole lot like what I would call the arising and passing away, or ANP is our shorthand we use.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, again, as we discussed, people can have the UFO experience, they end up in this territory, and you did the disclaimer, you gave a little bit of a disclaimer, but, you know, say somebody finds themselves in this kind of territory, right? With, you know, without getting, you know, a lot of times, like if you have some kind of UFO encounter experience or a near-death experience, right? You didn't ask for that. That's something that happened to you, and you're now you're in it, right? So you, what would be maybe some thoughts or insight on this for somebody? They're just in it, right? They just had maybe a UFO encounter, or maybe they had something that wasn't even the UFO encounter, like a very strange synchronicity that was tied to precognition or some type of meditative experience where they had this like a full-on Kundalini effect and now they don't know what to do. What would be your kind of thoughts for somebody in that they found themselves in the territory, and you know, what do they do at that point?
Well, I'm actually going to back up just slightly, if that's okay, and then answer the what to do question. So the other thing is, there's a wide range of like comfort with putting things in this sort of arising and passing away basket. I, for whatever reason, put a whole lot of things in that basket. Some people from the tradition don't put nearly as much in that basket. But the things I do put in that basket, being a pretty sort of put it in the basket kind of a person, is, so when people say near-death experiences, okay, there's kind of two varieties. There's the one where you're actually being coded, right? The paramedics are jumping up and down in your chest and shocking you with current, and your heart is not beating and all that kind of stuff. Right. So you've got, you know, or you're in some massively, you know, shocky coma or something. Right. So there's the thing where you're having the full on medical component going along with it. That's like near death experiences. And that's where it got its name, because you nearly died. Right. But then people use the word NDE all the time for stuff that mimic the NDE phenomena. Right. And the NDE phenomenon that people can report are things like going up out of their body, seeing the paramedics working on their body, feeling a sense of divine love and light, not wanting to come back, you know, given the choice, you know, floating up into the light, having a sense of everything is going to be fine, having secrets revealed to them, seeing through veils, like, you know, there's a whole list. I don't want to go through it. I'm no NDE expert, but you know, but they're actually being coded. They're actually like, they nearly did actually physically die. And then there's the NDE stuff where it's come into the terminology where they're having NDE-like phenomena, but they aren't actually being coded. Their heart's still beating, their blood pressure's fine. They're not at risk of sudden death any more than anybody else is. So they're still having what we call, you know, what, and so this language is actually creeping this way. Whereas I look at it the other way, I actually look at, because the phenomenology is so close, I actually look at near-death experiences were actually being coded, shocked, you know, dying or dead for a while, as a special variant of the arising and passing away, right? So whereas, because the phenomena, all of the phenomena that people describe in an NDE are phenomena that people can have in the ANP, right? And it just happens to be that sometimes that can be triggered by these extraordinarily traumatic nearly dying experiences. So that's the first thing I'm going to say. The second thing I'm going to say is Kundalini stuff. So from my point of view, again, being something of a lumper when it comes to this stuff, or put it all in the same basket, Kundalini stuff is all, everything pretty much says, someone says Kundalini, I throw almost all of it in this basket, right? The shaking, spontaneous movements, bright lights, sense of seeing energy channels, all that kind of stuff. Like I put it in basically the kind of ANP-esque territory, right? So again, it's my habit. So, and then the question is, what do you do if you find yourself in what I would lump into the ANP basket and other people would classify their other fine ways? And so it kind of depends on what's going on, right? So that's the next thing. Well, actually, the first thing I think is get some normalization for it. So people who are going through that with the only model they have is the Western one, is crazy, needs meds, right? or is a seizure or is bipolar or is mania or is psychosis, that's not a nice set of labels, right? Meaning usually broken for life, meds for life, all kinds of problems. Not a nice set of labels. And, you know, and there are people who go on meditation retreats and intentionally trying to have these experiences, and they have them and they can be healing, transformative, lead to other cool things, right? So I think, you know, I would tell my colleagues in medicine, hey, your set of labels and conceptual baskets you can put this in is inadequate because it doesn't really meet people what they are and predict outcomes, which might be amazing and beneficial. That's the first thing I would say. The second thing is it kind of depends on like how hard it hit, if they're able to sleep, if they're able to function normally in daily life, some aren't, like what kind of supports do they need? But normalization that this is a thing, and pointing them to the kind of literature around this, like A Path with Heart by Jack Kornfield, or, you know, The Stormy Search for the Self by the Grofs, or, you know, my own book goes into some stuff on this, and it references all kinds of other books that do as well. And there's lots of other techniques and traditions that I didn't mention at all that are still very good for handling these kinds of things, right? You can find this kind of technology in a lot of traditions because people go through it in a lot of settings. And so what I would say for them to do would really depend on what's going on. But the first thing I would say is at least read something. Nearly anything that you read is going to be likely better than having no frameworks or terms for it at all. And then go online and find communities and people who are used to dealing with and handling this stuff, which in the mainstream psychiatry and psychology world is generally people in transpersonal psychology or psychiatry, but also like people who do energy healing. They often know about this stuff, or various meditation teachers, hopefully, if they're trustworthy and ethical. A lot of the, you know, any of the traditions that have people go on, you know, do intensive practices, for example, are gonna hopefully have at least some rudimentary, if not sophisticated, understanding of this and maps and models. But having friends in this business who have been through it, who know something of the range of it, who have navigated it successfully, and have a sense of a tool basket that they can look at you and say, okay, if you're not able to sleep, maybe this tool. If you're like having weird movements, maybe this tool. And if you're like buying the paradigm in a way that is like totally derailing your life, like, you know, you are the next Messiah and the next, you know, Buddha Christ, you know, avatar or whatever, like, and you're running down the streets in a white robe or something. This happens to people. Like, this has happened to friends of mine. I'm not making this up. I shouldn't be laughing. It's only so funny when it happens. I mean, yes, it's kind of funny, but it's also kind of tragic, right? Because it usually goes pretty badly when they run into the police or, you know, the mental health services, right? So depending on what's going on, that becomes a long conversation. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah, that's also relative in the UFO field, where, you know, people have an experience and they define it in definite terms. And I understand completely why they do that, because I've had the experiences and it's so real, right? But I've managed to be able to take a step back and say, is that just my interpretation? Is it misdirect? You know, what are the possibilities here? I can't know for sure, but these are things I can observe, kind of thing. So I like to reflect in that way on it, because again, it can get, people can buy the narrative or whatever happens in the experience so hard. And I get it. And I get why, but you should at least give yourself the opportunity to look at it and say, what's really going on here? Because, you know, and I guess I learned that kind of approach from my meditative practices, right? Because I had been a practitioner the entire time from before some experiences I had, the kind of big ones in 2007. I was already practicing and continued to practice throughout the whole time. So I, even though at first when the experiences were happening, I was very like, this is actually what's happening. And then when I took a step back, I became more agnostic in that way, I guess, as a practice, right? But for people, I guess, like, that are in it, right? What kind of practices do you think may be useful for them to skillfully deal with those kind of emergent phenomena?
Again, there's a wide range here. And the other thing I'll talk about, what you just said, that sort of agnosticism about interpretation. I think being able to hold our interpretations lightly and evaluate them critically in terms of how they're allowing us to meet our life goals, which may be changing, right, and may modify, and maintain basic obligations and function and responsibilities if we can. And all of that is very valuable. And again, like, for example, let's say you were sitting on the couch and you all of a sudden saw an alien float through the wall, right?
Yeah.
And you were sitting there with your family watching TV. Okay. This is your actual experience.
Yeah.
And there's the alien. They floated through the wall. There's your family watching TV. How your life is going to go next could very well depend on how, not only how you interpret that, but how you react to that interpretation, right? Do you start acting like this is a threat? Do you start asking other people if they can see it? Do you start bowing down and worshiping it? Do you run screaming out the door into the street? Do you, like, what do you do? You know, do you have a conversation with it and then do exactly what it told you to do or something, right? Or, you know, like,
yeah.
these are things, and again, it sounds funny, except I actually talk with people who have these experiences, and I've had experiences like this. And there are people who can have these experiences and relate to them in a way that still maintains basic function. You know, Sigmund Freud gets a lot of flack in a whole lot of worlds for a whole lot of reasons. And I, okay, fine. But his basic definition of mental illness, that which interferes with love and work, I actually think it's a pretty solid one. And it's not like sometimes yeah. you might not need some interference with your work if you really did need to quit that crappy job and get a better one. Or maybe you did need some interference in your relationships because that relationship wasn't working out anyway. I don't know. Like, it's not my call. But you see what I mean? But most of the time, there's a way to take the experience and hold it in a light that leads to good function. And that's what I care about the most, really, from my clinical hat, you know, when I put that hat on. And the critical thing, the Freudian concept of ego strength means a lot of things. And in this case, it means the ability to face our experiences in a way that is sort of steady and reasonable. And so the question is, can you do that? And a lot of things could go better or worse depending on your capacity to do that. And so, that's the first thing I would like to really say is to validate your sense of ontological agnosticism, holding your frames lightly, relating to things hopefully in a skillful way, and be careful with the narrative. The other problem is the sense of noetic experiences. So noetic experiences is a term that usually refers to this profound sense of knowing. They have the sense that you know something. You have gotten the download and you are convinced, right? With that sense of special, overwhelmingly compelling knowledge, right? When you have that, just have somewhere in the back of your mind, yeah, but not in a critical or horrible way, but in a functional, reasonable way, some kind of skeptical doubt that goes, are we sure? And even if so, so what? And like, what else also might be important? Because when that noetic feeling hits, it can sort of overwhelm everything else and other concerns and other ordinary responsibilities. So figuring out how to have the sense of honoring the noetic quality of things that may be seemingly incredibly revelatory and transformative and consciousness or paradigm expanding while yet not wrecking your life, that's really the art to all of this. That's the first thing. Again, the second thing, the biggest thing I would find, again, first, find people you can talk about this with. So that's the practice I'm going to recommend first, because all the others are going to stem from that. Skillful, sane, reasonable people who are non-exploitative, not going to try to get you to join their special cult or take their, you know, whatever expensive med necessarily, or whatever it is. You know, it's not like medications can't occasionally be useful in these sorts of situations. They can be. So I don't want to poo-poo all medications. That's not my goal here, and to cut off therapeutic options when they might really be of value. But the ability to have thoughtful conversations about ways to look at things and what these things are is really one of the first and most important things you have to do. And not everybody has that. That's the other problem. So luckily there are communities online where you can talk about these. You probably know those better than I for this particular topic. Oh, where do you think they should go?
The experiencer group is one place they can go. It's a secure place where experiencers can share without being, you know, criticized, and the information will stay within that closed forum. And J. Christopher King and others run that. So that's the experiencer group. I've had a group for a long time, since maybe 2009, called the CE5 Initiative on Facebook. And that's for anybody that's into contact work. And you know, there's now UFO Twitter, so you can go on Twitter if you're kind of more open about it and open to hearing criticism. Because if you're doing it on Twitter, you're going to get the criticism. But if you have some resilience, that can actually be very helpful, I find. You know, but again, there's going to be some that's unfair criticism, but there is a way. You know, I like to do a little practice, thinking if we all combined create one mind, right? And this unconscious collective is there, kind of, that you can tap into. Maybe if you do it in a very literal way by collecting from the collective, you're kind of doing the same thing in reverse. So I like to get feedback from other people and hear from other people sometimes. But so do you think, and I'm going to get a little bit into the Dharma stuff, right? People know I'm interested in that. And of course you are, Daniel. So, I mean, do you think somebody could utilize or skillfully use an experience like that? Like, say they're on the, you know, they have an experience and they're kind of on the path now. So it's like, what do they do? Is there a way they can catapult from like an A&P and kind of make use of that experience and kind of new view in a way? Almost like, would it be, you know, can they go for stream entry? And you know, can because in a way, like, can somebody just through that experience and through the growth that comes afterwards obtain something like a right view, and they're using that skillfully to cope with their experiences, emergent phenomena, the phenomenon, and maybe even in their whatever their pursuits are.
Yeah. All right. So for those who don't know all these terms, right? So there's a bunch of terms you just used, and I'll try to unpack those, right? So the first one is stream entry. So this is a concept that comes out of old school Theravada Buddhism. So this is really old Buddhism. And it's the notion of a first stage of awakening that would... So if you look at the way the maps work, you would, in the first stage, you would see thoughts as thoughts, right? Stage number one, mind and body. Then you see cause and effect, which can cause, like, if you ever like meditated and noticed your attention was interfering with your breath, that one. Then three characteristics is weird body twistings and tensions and strange stuff. All of these could be the subject of an hour discussion, but I'm just going to really summarize, you know, and the sort of energy blockages and, oh, what the heck? And then, you know, the arising and passing away is the energy bursting through, Kundalini stuff, peak experiences, all that. Again, I'm kind of a basket lumper. Some people don't like that. Fine. And then next one, dissolution. Which is the sense of the body dissolving, being out of phase, all the energy and excitement and rapture and bliss and stuff of the spiritual high falling away. And then the sense of like maybe things dissolving or darkness or confusion or low energy or something. And then we get into what we call the knowledges of suffering or the dark night. If you're one of these people, again, who's happy to lump a whole bunch of the maps together, which I am. And so dissolution, next comes fear, misery, disgust, desire for deliverance, reobservation. These often can sort of come as a package, and this is like not nice. So the basic point is, after peak experience, it is not uncommon to have a sense of existential crisis, of the sense of issues bubbling up with a force and velocity that you didn't have before, of the sense of energetic buzziness and irritation and mind doing things that don't make any sense, getting bent out of shape about things, becoming paranoid, becoming, you know, weird, a lot of grief in this process, becoming super frustrated or critical with partners, work, jobs, life, school, teachers, everything, right? And then sort of, you know, touching your own madness thing, and then poof. And then the next stage, if you get past all that, is opening out into the expansive state called equanimity, knowledge of equanimity. And then that, synchronize, disappear, reappear. Ah, sort of like the summary shortcut of like how someone might get something called stream entry. Now, this is, again, someone is probably cringing at the super short summary I did of a ridiculously complicated topic. So my apologies to any of the traditionalists out there. But the basic map, spiritual high, crash and challenge, like this is the hero's journey, like, I am the hero. Whoa, I have to go on the hero's journey into the underworld. Okay, now I'm okay and back home and everything's fine, but somehow wiser and better, and then divine revelation or something, right? So this is like that kind of arc is the same sort of pattern we're talking about here. And the first thing is acknowledging you are on the journey. The second thing is finding the aesthetics of the journey supports that you like, right? So there's something about aesthetic resonance, and like, do you, maybe you were raised Catholic and you just super like Catholic mysticism, that's your thing, or maybe you were raised agnostic and suddenly like you're finding yourself super compelled to go Zen retreats or who knows, or whatever it is. Like there's acknowledging that you might need the supports and technologies and of something of a tradition is really an important step. And then pretty much all of the traditions will have some kind of technology for dealing with what to do next. I'm going to give you a few basic bits of advice that I think are likely to be helpful for all of them. First is, don't get too super fascinated by the spiritual highs. They don't last. And this is a common time for people to say, I am awakened, I am enlightened. Nobody could ever have been as enlightened as me, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, that's what they all said. Cool, right? And it fades. And then the Dark Knight is like, oh, like, this is awful. And then you forget like perspective, you forget space, you forget that most of your experience is actually fine. And it can have this weird sort of contracted, ah! So remembering space, remembering the body, remembering to ground down, deactivate the default mode network by being in consensus space, physical things with yoga, techniques like Dzogchen and Mahamudra. Like I tend to recommend books to people along the lines of Shift into Freedom by Locke Kelly, for example. Cool Tech. There's a lot of these. You can read my book and I give a whole series of recommendations there. In my own book, it's free online at mctb.org. That's mctb.org. You can even download a PDF. And the audio book is coming soon. We're about halfway done with it. Yay.
Are you narrating it?
I did not have the time to do this. It's like 200 hours to actually do all that work. I didn't have 200 hours.
I was hoping to hear your voice one day, man.
No, it's got to be the excellent voice of a friend. So I think you'll like the result. I think it's turning out.
I think it will be great to be able to listen to.
Yeah,
because you know, I mean, some people they are better learners when they listen. It just you know, it's a thing. Some people are better when they watch a video.
Yeah.
So to have those options or even combine the options, you can like listen to it and read along.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be awesome that there's an audio component. And again, I recommend anybody watching and listening, check out Daniel's book. Even if you're only interested in UFOs and look at the phenomenology stuff.
Chapter 30 and then the magic section of part 6 are pretty much for you.
Right. I was going to say, go through some of the sections and look around and you're going to find some really interesting stuff.
Thanks. And it's going to reference all kinds of other people's interesting stuff. Not all of which agrees with me, by the way. I reference people that don't always see the things, you know, the way I do to try to get some balance of perspective here. So definitely check out some of the other sources.
Yeah. And, you know, so say people are, you know, they're watching and listening. They don't give a damn. They're going to get into this kind of crazy stuff. They, you know, they want to go, they're in the mess already. They're going to just go for it regardless. Right.
Okay.
They're the people like me who stuck a paperclip in a socket to see what happens, you know? So given such, can you explain what Fire Casino is? Cause I've been wanting to experiment utilizing Fire Casino in different doses. You know, even like saying, even doing an hour of Fire Casino a day or 2 hours a day, will that have a carryover effect? Will that the concentration power carry over into CE5 and contact work? Right.
Yes.
That's so I'm definitely going to experiment with that. I just have to set up a schedule to do it. So for people interested in Fire Casino or high concentration levels and might want to apply something like that to even if they're a remote viewer or or into
Remote viewer. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you're into any of this kind of stuff, you've talked about Fire Casina and basically revived it in like the modern Dharma world. What is Fire Casina and what can you expect from it?
Okay. So the first thing I want to say is this is not safe. Like before I even tell you what the heck this is, by way of full disclosure, this can make you super weird and you've been warned. Like, and I like, oh yeah, I'll be fine. Maybe. Right. So I had someone who recently did a Fire Casina retreat with me, and they showed up and this is a person who had taken hundreds of hits of acid, up to 600 mics, had done like, you know, intensive silent, you know, meditation retreats and all kinds of stuff, and thought they would be fine. 2.5 days in, they were like, this is way too much. I'm out of here. See ya. And they had signed up for 3 weeks. Right. So like, just, it doesn't mean it's going to be that way for you. That's obviously high dose all day long. So kind of a different thing, you know, but just realize this is the real thing. It does real stuff. Treat it as seriously as you would treat a powerful psychedelic, and you will likely have better outcomes. Okay. There you go. Who you do it with, you know, what setting, what kind of space you're in, with what intentions, see if you can have all those as good as they can possibly be. And so that's the first thing. Okay. You've been warned. There's other warnings on the website. You can go to Fire Casina, FireKasina.org. That's casino with a K. And what casino means, it's an old Pali word, and Pali is a language like Sanskrit, and it's a language a lot of the old Buddhist texts were written down in, like that one there. And this is, this means using an external thing as a support for concentration, okay? And there's 10 casinas, of which the Fire Casina is one of them. It's an elemental casino. And these are almost certainly pre-Buddhist texts. So the Buddhists elaborated on these, and they built them out into these cool systems in books like the Visuddhimagga and the Vimuttimagga. And so you can find those books online. So once you get it into this, what you do is you take a candle flame or a light source. If it's a bright light source, you don't look at it very long. If it's a candle flame, you look at it for like a minute. I wouldn't recommend really bright light sources. Candle flame is not going to hurt your eyes. That's the cool thing. Look at the candle flame right at it for a minute or so. Close your eyes. Eventually out of that, you're going to see like a red dot. It might become like a yellow dot. And then it wanders off to the side. You follow it. You do whatever you do. Eventually you're like, I got nothing I can focus on. You open your eyes, you look at the candle flame, and you do it again. And you do it again. And you do it again. And then there's all kinds of like questions and answers and stuff on the Fire Casina website. You can find like the Denman Island 2018 Frequently Asked Questions Project, where we have like 3.5 hours of answering like 61 common questions for beginners. So this is all free. You know, we're not selling anything. There's a book there that you can download for free, by the way, or you can order it at print cost. We don't make any money on it. So, and this is all open source tech. And we've crowdsourced a whole lot of people's reports from explorations in this. But basically what it does is, if you've ever been like a kid and you were like playing around with the colors on the backs of your eyelids, it's that stuff, except you just do it in really high dose. And then that can eventually lead to stuff that is as strong and powerful as DMT, to be able to, you know, see the, you know, etheric field through your experience, to entities, energies, transformations of consciousness, stages of insight, stages of awakening, deep archetypal journeys, real profound challenges, and super weird stuff that is hard to map, and good luck. So this is what I do when I go on retreat. Every single retreat I've gone on has been different. I don't think we have anything like an understanding of what the range of this practice is. But what I know for certain it does is dramatically increase the ability to see stuff, hear stuff, particularly if you add a mantra to it while you're doing it, and particularly if you do it in higher dose. And to get into the kind of territory and experiences that you probably thought were always just talk when, you know, ceremonial magicians talk about like drawing symbols in the air and being able to see the fire, you know, coming off your fingers. You can really do this with Fire Casino within a week or two if you're a good practitioner and don't lose your furry little mind. So for any of these kinds of protocols, remote viewing, seeing images, tuning the radio, and gaining the sense of like the inner landscape and access to the power, you know, just, you know, power corrupts, be careful, keep your ethical wits about you, and proceed with caution is my best advice, if you proceed at all.
Yeah. And you mentioned how the dosing, or, you know, the duration in which you do the practice per day for that kind of deep effect.
Yeah, more dose is going to be more. So like when, you know, when I go do this on retreat, I like at least 8, 10, 12 hours a day, if not 16, 18, right? And so that's a lot of time doing this strange thing, and it can cause things to become super psychedelic. And the other thing, I've got some other podcasts on this, by the way, not to direct you to other people's podcasts, but
you can
check out my podcast on Michael Taft and
those are great.
And Guru Viking. And yes, there's some other places I've talked about this, and relationship to the powers you can find on Chaotic Thinking with Liminal Warmth and Monk on a Motorbike. There's some other extensive podcasts I've done talking about magic and ethics and experiences and stuff. So if you like that kind of thing, those are other places you can find it.
And actually, you know, that was, I remember it was on Guru Viking, and, you know, Guru Viking, I've actually had him here on this channel once.
Oh, cool.
You talked about on the Fire Casino episode, which I highly recommend everybody watching this, go see the entire episode Daniel did on Fire Casino. It's absolutely extraordinary. You'll get the full detail on Fire Casino through that one for sure. What was I going to say? The Guru Viking. Man, I lost where I was going with that now.
That's all right. No worries.
Sorry about that.
So, yeah, and more dose leads to more effects, but I know people on relatively small dose that got into some really interesting territory, and small dose to me is an hour or two per day or like whatever. And it enhances the visual field. I literally see better. Everybody who I've ever done this with in high dose says, I now see better after this. Colors are more vibrant. My visual field is clearer. It's a thing.
Do you think if somebody practiced for 1 to 2 and maybe on like the weekends, 3 hours a day, that they would ever be able to get to that very high level of concentration? Or do you think that you need to do it within a short time for it to, or you can eventually get the effects from the smaller dose?
Yeah, no, it varies by the person and the phase of practice and all kinds of other things I don't really know very well. So the first thing I'll say about that is I've gone on retreats with groups, and sometimes we've had people who came along and they just wanted to do like 2 or 3 or 4, sometimes 5 hours, something much lower dose than the rest of us were doing. What we noticed is that they eventually got to a lot of the stuff that we got to in 7 or 10 days. They got to in 12, 14, 15, something.
Oh, wow.
Right. So they get there sometimes. Again, these are people with talent. That's why they're coming on these retreats. We already have a sense that they have a resonance with this thing. So this is not a normal group. So it's a skewed sample, to be fair.
Yeah.
But but they often lack the sense of like control and the sense of confidence in it. So there's something about their threshold effects for like deep access to images, colors, realms, being able to really invoke and all of that, with a sense of like, I can just do this like I can move my hand.
Yeah.
Right. I can do this like I say words. I can call up whatever or go to wherever or do whatever with that sense of natural effortlessness or minimal effort. Right. And that sense of confidence. Whereas the people who are doing it in lower dose usually like chance into stuff and they're like, oh my golly, I had this and then it was gone and I don't know how to get it back.
Yeah.
Right. Whereas the people who are doing it in higher dose, when they chance into, is like, oh yeah, I chanced into this. And then I figured out, oh, I all have to do is this, and then I can do that again. And then I like, there often is a lot more sense of a facility with it.
And do you think that you've only experienced this kind of stuff with Fire Casino and not other concentration practices?
I've done other concentration practices and gotten into some of this territory sometimes, but not anything like as reproducibly. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't other cool practices that can't get you into this territory. I don't mean to be like a Fire Casino maximalist or evangelist, right? But it is clearly one of the techniques that can do this. And I'm sure there are a number of others.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that would be a fascinating idea to apply it to some of these other, like something like contact work. I remembered what I was going to say before is on Guru Viking, you were talking about your friend who was into ceremonial magic.
Honey Bunny.
Yeah. So he was able to develop different abilities or skills through a different practice. Is that right? Or was it fundamentally the same but different under verbiage?
So A, talented practitioner, clearly had some underlying capacity. B, serious practitioner, gave a lot of time to real visualization practices and doing, this is a ritual practitioner. So they're doing ceremonial magic stuff and, you know, really trying to see each of the things and really tuning in and lots of repetition, and that can make all of the stuff more accessible. So they're clearly, you know, more ritual practice with more focus and more intent and more sense of compelling belief in what you are seeing and expected to see and going to see and all of that, you know, particularly if you have some talent, and also did plenty of meditation of various styles. So yeah, a real practitioner, like in a lot of senses.
Yeah.
So I think that all helps support it.
Yeah. And I want to say too, for something like contact work, it could be the same way. In that, you know, if you're serious about doing contact work, you actually have to do practice, and eventually you're going to develop it, that capacity. You know, whether you combine that with meditation, I think if you're doing contact work, things like jhana or shamatha, you know, tranquility and concentration, and what I personally like to use in my own kind of like protocol or contact modality is metta.
Yeah. You know,
that is, for me, that kind of loving kindness approach, or even just feeling gratitude and inviting an interaction, for me, that's been very powerful. And it's something that is kind of like innate to me. It would be my own strength for some reason that works very well for me.
Awesome.
Yeah. So, but for EPRC, what do you have upcoming with the EPRC?
Oh, wow. Well, that's a good question. So maybe I should also differentiate some things here.
Okay.
So I'm gonna do a little differentiation, then talk about the EPRC a little bit more. I kind of wear three different hats, and I'm sort of three different Daniels. There's Daniel number one that wrote that book on Buddhism and started having experiences as a kid and did a whole lot of practice, mostly in Buddhist context, but not all. You know, adopted the sort of hybrid modern fusion variant of map technology that uses its own proprietary language and stuff, and is comfortable with all that, but has helped, you know, has worked in a lot of traditions and talked to a lot of traditions and have a lot of friends in a lot of traditions, but very much like a spiritual, magical, mystical, et cetera, practitioner, right? And then there's Daniel number two, who was like, you know, physics and chemistry major and electrical engineering and public health and biostatistics, epidemiology, and then medicine, and then you know, healthcare administration and emergency medicine and all that kind of stuff, right? So that this Daniel is, you know, these two Daniels didn't always totally get along, right? And so, and then there's the third Daniel, which is the EPRC Daniel. And the EPRC Daniel looks at the previous two Daniels and go, bunch of cool stuff here, doesn't scale globally, the language is too proprietary and is going to alienate people, the maps haven't been validated by science, you know, and, you know, needs all kinds of work. But this Daniel number two, Dr. Daniel, clearly has a totally inadequate understanding of what Daniel one knows, and but has some of the tools and the clinical sensibilities and the scientific methods and now neuroimaging and outcomes, you know, techniques and all kinds of stuff that could bring forward a lot of the Daniel one stuff into something that does scale linguistically, conceptually, with a whole lot of other help and a lot of other traditions, a lot of people and a lot of multidisciplinary work and linguistics and cultural stuff and a whole lot of things, right? So just so people, like, if you watch me flip hats, what I'm talking about, like Daniel the practitioner doing Fire Casino, that's this Daniel. Daniel number two, scientist, that Daniel. And Dan number three is the Daniel I'm about to flip into that's trying to figure out how those two can get along a whole lot better. And that's the EPRC point of view, right? So putting on my EPRC hat, the EPRC looks at all of this and is trying to figure out how in the world we can do all of the science and neuroimaging to make these two things get along a whole lot better and use the best of both of them to help people who are dealing with this stuff and their families and societies to have better outcomes. That's what the EPRC cares about, right? And so what's coming up for the EPRC? We're doing a bunch of fundraising right now. So I've got a fundraising trip coming up where we're going to talk to a bunch of people To do all the science is very expensive. It just costs a whole lot of money. We have a pretty impressively large team. We have a lot of plans and dreams, and we know how to do science. But it does take a lot of cash, all of which we haven't anything like found, right? So that's one of the first things we're focusing on. You know, how do you, you know, if you really want good science, it's going to cost. And you can do bad science for low money, but it's hard to do good science at that kind of scale with these complicated questions for small money. And so that's one of the big things we have coming up. We have a paper coming out in mindfulness that I think it just got accepted. That's basically a call for the empirical study of some meditation traditions to say, hey, did they actually lead to traditional effects? Right, like mindfulness often claims that, like, hey, mindfulness is just calming down, couldn't lead to anything weird. Whereas those of us who have been on meditation retreats know paying attention can do more than just calming down, relating more skillfully to your thoughts coming and going, right? It's more than that. And so so we have a paper coming out on that. We have a bunch of EEG data coming out on, or some papers, I think two papers that hopefully will be coming out relatively soon that relate to basically meditators looking at, like, going through advanced stages and states and that stuff coming out. There's something called the effect index. So if you do psychedelics, the effect index is hopefully almost done with its ability to really upgrade its capacity to crowdsource trip reports. So if you have interesting trip reports and want to contribute to the literature of what psychedelics can do, and hopefully soon enough what meditation can do, is what we dream of this, then you can contribute reports to Psychonaut Wiki, which we've helped fund. We have a study of what happens when people take psychedelics and then they don't really land. They go up, but they don't really fully come down, yeah. Right? Or they land pretty strangely, right? So the difficult psychedelic experiences study, that's with Jules Evans and his team. And we're interviewing a whole lot of people. It turns out, like, there's almost no data on this, which is super bizarre. You'd think someone would have seriously studied this, but most psychedelic studies were done by the rah-rah psychedelic teams, right? Which is okay, but they didn't really want to look at the potential challenges and how to handle them. So we have a study, hopefully this data analysis that's being done now, where we're looking at a bunch of people's survey data on, like, hey, they had a psychedelic, they didn't quite land, what helped them, what didn't, how did it get, you know, explained at the time, how did they think about it, you know, what did they find, and what works, and what should we be studying to say, hey, a bunch of people thought this was really useful, can we do that in, like, a clinical trial of these people? So to try to help them do that. And so those are some of the, you know, we have a whole lot going on. It's a massive team. Like, I don't, you know, I just said a few things about some stuff. We've got some advanced meditator and scanner studies happening at Harvard. That's very exciting. And MGH and Martinos Imaging Center. That's very exciting. People are doing work related to psychedelics at Imperial College London. It's Chris Timmerman, people like that. Yeah, a lot going on. That was just some highlights. And apologize, EPRC people whose studies I didn't mention, yours are good too. Oh, a fun one by Mike Daw is actually, does diet make these experiences more likely? So is it true that vegans and vegetarians are more prone to spiritual experiences? Answer might actually be yes, actually. And you should check out Mike Daw's work. It's his PhD thesis he's doing in the UK.
Yeah, and that gets also to some of these, like, fasting on a retreat or some of the experiments with fasting. Yeah, there's all different things you can do to augment your consciousness.
That is true. And or so fasting and not sleeping are the two big ones, right?
I was going to say sleep deprivation. I know very well.
So fasting and not sleeping, these simultaneously, if you're having a really hard time getting into weird territory, can definitely break down some barriers naturally. Yeah. But if you're already into weird territory, they can definitely remove critical sort of safety backstops that might have kept you from going into territory that you really can't handle. So, like, be careful with using those and pushing too far, particularly if you're the kind of people who are already prone to deep experiences. Be very careful with those. They can push things too much.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes you find that out the hard way, right?
Yeah, right. As William Blake said, you often don't know what's enough until you know what's more than enough. But you can still hear the warnings from people who know. So
yeah, and what you mentioned about people not landing. I mean, that sometimes happens with people who have a close encounter and they don't know how to cope with it, and because that experience was so shocking, they lose their grounding and now they don't know what to believe, and you know. That's why I think what EPRC is doing is so important.
Thanks.
Yeah, because you know I think it's ahead of its time in some ways, where I think it's gonna help people who find themselves and you know, these kind of areas or realms or experiences, where there's just more coming out on it, you know, in the public, and you know, they mm-hmm. know they're not the only ones having that kind of experience. And that if you have an experience like that, there's some information that you can read on it, other than, you know, again, going to somebody and possibly diagnosing you incorrectly. And I think that the development of the EPRC, complements kind of the public dialogue of UFO disclosure, so to speak, even though there's holdbacks on that and what have you, but you know, it's good timing. It's good timing. Thanks.
I actually think, unfortunately, given how long some of these like longitudinal outcome studies for like diagnostic and management options and comparative trials and stuff are going to take, I think we're probably, you know, like 2 or 3 decades behind.
Yeah.
But you know, we're going to try to catch up as fast as we can and still do the science properly. The other thing is, if any of you out there are scientists or, you know, have some skills you might lend to this project, are clinicians, are, you know, data scientists, have some kind of thing that you're like, oh, I'll bet that would be useful to the EPRC team, and you're interested in helping, please let us know. The other thing is, if you're a philanthropist or know people who have some philanthropic capacity, and you thought, hey, wouldn't it be great if the clinical mainstream and scientific mainstream weren't such a barrier to these kinds of things, and we had some better options that can help well-meaning clinicians to add more value to care rather than stigma, then please get in touch with us. I should also mention, I'm a volunteer in all of this. I give money to this project. I'm not getting anything out of this. So it's like, oh, he's asking for money for him. No, I'm not. No. I spend my money on this project. I'm not getting anything out of this. It's all volunteer for me. So, and a number of us on the team, including the whole board of Emergence Benefactors, the charity that helps support the EPRC, we're all volunteers. And so we're just doing this because we think it needs to be done in the world, because we know so many people who would have benefited from this having already been done. And so we're trying to make sure it at least gets done for future people and generations who will have the benefit of a substantially upgraded clinical capacity to add value and reduce diagnoses that may not lead to optimal outcomes.
Right. And you know, maybe in some future near, you know, not too far down the future, but who knows, maybe one day, you know, if there is something of like a disclosure, there'll be a, people can actually go to somebody if they had an experience, you know, in a perfect world in the future, who knows.
Right. I mean, and they would get reasonable support. That's what we're trying to do.
Yeah. I think that, you know, again, people working in this direction, I think it needs to happen. But where can people find all the information on the EPRC?
Go to theeprc.org. That's theeprc.org. Or you can email at us at info@theeprc.org. Thanks.
And you, the EPRC also has a YouTube channel and a Twitter account.
Yep.
So you can follow on Twitter and definitely watch the YouTube videos. They have a video where Daniel kind of has a long form breakdown of what the EPRC is and what they're doing. I think it's very, it's great. I sent it to some, a number of people.
Nice.
So
this obviously to upgrade the clinical mainstream involves a large number of steps. So one of the things that people start to find is the EPRC is kind of an overwhelming plan. Yes, it is.
Yeah.
But the number of steps and stages that we think you need to do, just kind of like, what does it take to get a drug through the FDA? It's a lot of stages and truckloads of paperwork, right? And it takes a long time. This is kind of that, except even a harder ask. And so our plans are elaborate. Our dreams and, you know, our each of the steps and stages, all of the components are vast. We've really mapped this out with extreme degrees of care, and I think a way that hasn't really been done before. So, and this is open source tech. If y'all want to do it or help or, you know, whatever, it's going to take a whole lot of people to get this done properly. All previous attempts to do this have failed. So going back 140 years, to, you know, since the cosmic consciousness people in the 1880s. And so we're going to need help. So just when you run into the EPRC, just understand the very, very large, hopefully will be much larger thing that it currently is.
Yeah. And do you have any parting words for the audience or like any seekers out there who are, let's figure at this point there, they found my channel, they found Engaging the Phenomenon, they found this interview, they're somewhere on the path, right? So
yeah, right.
What advice would you give to seekers out there?
Yeah. Wise community. I think that's the most important thing. I keep saying it, but if you can find friends in this that are decent, non-exploitative, have their heads screwed on straight, particularly those who have spent more time than this in you, in this territory than you have, figuring out how to relate to it in a way that leads to good life outcomes, that's the most important thing. So don't hesitate to reach out if you can find these people.
All right, definitely. Well, thank you so much, Daniel, for coming on, and I look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Awesome. It's been delightful. Thank you so much for all the amazing work that you do and for helping to highlight these issues. Really great service.
Thank you so much. Take care.